streaming issues by late June 2021. The Iran security chief says Israel is the greatest enemy of the Muslim world, in reaction to the Saudi crown prince calling Israel a potential ally. Plus, Russian President Vladimir Putin says any country that imposes a no-fly zone over Ukraine will be considered as a party to the conflict with Russia. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says that Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have agreed on a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues.
In the agreement we made with the IAEA and the negotiations that took place within the past days and weeks between us and Mr. Grossi, today we announced this agreement with a statement. There are steps we're taking to cooperate with each other in the form of mutual assistance. We decided to exchange the necessary documents between Iran and the IAEA by June 21st.
The Islami was speaking at a press conference with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, in Tehran. He said the IAEA's decisions should not be affected by lobbying or political influences and intervention. He expressed hope that cooperation between Iran and the agency will follow a professional and non-political procedure. The Islami also noted that full withdrawal of anti-Iran allegations are the country's red lines in the Vienna talks, which he said are in their final stage. Then Rafael Grossi stressed that the safeguards issues with Iran should be resolved in order for the 2015 deal to be revived. The IAEA chief described his talks with the Islami as intense but fruitful. Grossi has also met with the Iranian foreign minister. His Tehran visit comes as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are in Vienna negotiating the revival of the accord. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Adi Shamkhani, calls Israel the biggest enemy of the Muslim world. Shamkhani made the comment in a tweet after the Saudi crown prince talked about the kingdom's relationship with the Israeli regime. Mohammed bin Salman said that Riyadh is looking for ways to coexist with Iran but does not look at Israel as an enemy. He also said that Tel Aviv will probably be an ally of Riyadh in the future. The top Iranian security official also referred to bilateral talks between Tehran and Riyadh. He said the talks hosted by Iraq stem from Iran's principled strategy of cooperating with its neighbors based on bilateral and regional interests. Those talks are aimed at diffusing tensions over a host of issues, including the Yemen war. Israel and the United Arab Emirates boost their ties further, with Abu Dhabi allowing Tel Aviv to resume a full schedule of flights to the Sheikhdom. Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, says the two sides have settled a dispute over airport security that forced them to cut back air services. Israel's flag carrier Al Al has welcomed the announcement, saying that it will immediately return to operating up to four flights a day. Non-stop flights from Tel Aviv to Dubai were among the issues agreed upon as part of a U.S.-backed normalization deal between Israel and the UAE. That deal was clinched in 2020, drawing strong backlash from Muslims and Palestinians who see the accord as a betrayal of their cause. Reactions are pouring in following a deadly suicide bombing that devastated a Shia mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar on Friday. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the bombing. He said places of worship should be safe havens, not targets of attacks. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the tragic incident also. He called on Islamabad to tackle terrorist groups and not to allow them to commit crimes against innocent people, especially religious minorities. Iran said the attack was aimed at sowing discord among Muslims. The European Union slammed the bombing as a heinous crime. The blast targeted worshippers during Friday prayers, killing nearly 60 people and injuring dozens more. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility. Journalists and political commentators say Mohsen Abbas says terrorists in Pakistan are so ruthless that they don't even spare children.
77 attacks were launched in the first four months of 2021. And it's not unknown that they target even children. I mean, in Kabul, there was a car bomb that hit 85 people who were killed, but it was actually 300 others injured. And it was a girls' school that they were targeting. So you see, they're very ruthless. Their origins are traced to 2015, when they apparently broke away from the Taliban mainstream with a very hardline ideology, and for them the Taliban weren't hard enough in terms of Sharia or any of the ideological side of things. But what's really been a game changer, and where the US, for instance, and even the Zionists and RAW, the Indian agencies, are implicated, is that there was a huge influx of around 5,000 to 10,000 fighters from Iraq and Syria that joined the IS Khorasan ranks and swelled them. And since then, they've been the primary thorn in the side of now, of course, Taliban, but of course the Pakistan intelligence services, who've been doing huge operations to keep them under control.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Moscow's offensive in Ukraine is in its 10th day, with Russian forces inching closer to the capital, Kiev. Russian troops have encountered stiff resistance along the way, including in Kiev's western suburbs and the northern town of Chernihiv. Russia has announced a ceasefire in the besieged port city of Mariupol, as well as the nearby town of Volnovakha, to allow civilians to evacuate. However, Russia's defense ministry says no one has used the two humanitarian corridors and has accused Ukrainian nationalists of preventing civilians from leaving. Ukrainian officials have accused Moscow of violating the truce and shelling Mariupol. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned against imposing a no-fly zone on Ukraine.
Any country that seeks to impose a no-fly zone will be considered by us to have entered the conflict. Imposing a no-fly zone will have colossal and catastrophic consequences, not only for Europe, but also the whole world.
Putin says that Western sanctions are akin to a declaration of war. He reiterated that his country aims to defend the Russian-speaking communities in Ukraine through demilitarizing and denazifying the country. The fighting began on February 24. The UN Refugee Agency has reported the departure of 1.3 million refugees from Ukraine so far. Christopher Horstel is a writer, politician, and analyst who joins us from Berlin. We also have James Tweedy, who's a journalist and writer who joins us from Plymouth. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Christopher Horstel, if I may. We're looking at the 10th day of operations that Russia has exerted on Ukraine. The one side we don't hear much about, of which we hear from Russia, is the denazifying the extreme nationals, and also regarding the demilitarization. Tell us the side that Russia is narrating, because it's not the narration or the line that Western media is reporting.
Yeah, we have an information war right now in highest gear, really top gear. We have all kinds of, you know, secret service activities, for example, in the recently Russian-occupied city of Kherson, where the population, reportedly by New York Times and things like that, takes to the street to protest against the Russian side, and that doesn't seem credible. The group is small, but the camera movements are vivid. So we see this kind of thing. We see also that the strategy and tactics of Russia were in fact anticipating a smoother transition. Nobody in the West is giving Ukraine the faintest chance to truly withstand the Russian army. That is very natural. We don't need to discuss that. But the fact is that the Ukrainian government wants to, you know, drown the country in weapons coming from the West. They are largely, you know, then taken over by the Russian army as they approach. But this means this president of Ukraine is ready to ruin his country in order to, you know, make a deal with Washington that he is their leader in Ukraine. That is crazy. He has another 2 months, I think, then he's gone. And now the Russian side will have to change the way. They need to put more people inside. They have used tank columns and truck columns. That is not enough. They need more people on the ground to really rule the situation. And this leads to this announcement by President Putin just a few hours ago that Ukraine may lose its statehood if it continues to wage a fierce war, in fact, against Russian people. Russian people fighting Russian people is a wonderful story for Washington. They love to, you know, push Muslims against Muslims, and now they're putting Slavish people against Slavs, and that is a hobby, obviously not, you know, racist or religious. It's just that they are criminals in Washington.
Well, that's a very dangerous concoction here that Washington is stirring, if that is indeed the case, James Tweedy. And we're looking also at reports aside from the fact of what our guest said about the West, even Germany has ramped up its arms to Ukraine and a host of other countries, of course the U.S. also, but also reports of how these mercenaries are now being brought into Ukraine, many coming from what we understand, Syria, U.S.-backed, supported, or otherwise. Why is the West so keen on having this environment, this militarization of this conflict, knowing what it's going to lead to, which at this point we're seeing, you know, civilian deaths slowly but surely ratchet up? So this is for James Tweedy. I'm sorry.
Well,
go ahead, James Tweedy.
Yes. Thanks for inviting me today. The West doesn't really care about the Ukrainian people in this. I mean, it's the European Union and NATO want to expand. They want to keep expanding. It's like classic imperialism. You must expand or else you stagnate and you die. So they will always seek new territories. And you see how the European Union economically treats many of the later members from Eastern Europe and some, and many of the older members from Southern Europe as pawns, just to provide cheap labor for the most, you know, the richest countries of the EU, like Germany and France. And that's already happening, by the way, with Ukraine. I mean, we talk about a migrant crisis and, you know, a refugee crisis now because of the war. But actually, I mean, many people say that millions of people have already emigrated from Ukraine. Some have gone to the West, to the European Union, and those who speak Russian have gone to Russia. The shelling by the Ukrainian army before the Russian army intervened created another 700,000 refugees from the Donbass region going to Russia. This is the US and NATO more generally is ready to push the world to the brink of nuclear war just to gain some kind of advantage over Russia, for instance, putting their missiles, nuclear missiles, possibly, you know, ballistic missiles within a few hundred miles of Moscow, where they could actually, you know, destroy Moscow before the alarm could be raised. Of course, Russia is not going to allow that. And people talk about Ukraine's right, sovereign right, as a country to decide whether it joins the NATO alliance or not, or the European Union, but, you know, those sovereign rights have to be weighed against the collective security of the whole world as it is now, or at least the Northern Hemisphere, everybody living in the life of everybody living in the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at some social media posts on this, and we'll get right back to you. Our first post. NATO failed to make a tangible conversation. They wrongfully assumed Putin would not bomb Ukraine willfully. Now they're supplying Ukraine with arms so that Ukrainian lives can be destroyed to prove that they are not afraid of Putin or Russia. Putin's waging war in Ukraine will have catastrophic consequences for Russia's economy and standing in the world. RF will be isolated from the West in trade and any relations. Russians will not be allowed in even for travel and lose access to Western goods, supplies, and brain power. When this war in Ukraine is over, Putin will not be a force in Russia. Russians will really turn against him and all these sanctions. Russia will be on their knees. He has made NATO stronger. And our final post, actually, no-fly zone is always a defensive move. NATO claims to be a defensive alliance, but they are too scared of Putin and use Zelensky as a puppet to hit on Russia's economy. It was all pre-planned by U.S. and NATO, and the Ukrainian people suffered. Okay, those were some of our social media posts. Actually, the last one is pretty, pretty interesting, so I'm going to address that to you, Christopher Horsdale, if I may. Because this is what the U.S. has wanted to do, One way or another, obviously Russia has been on its radar. China and Russia, number one and two, I believe, in terms of what the U.S. considers as national security threats. And, of course, we're seeing the economic war that's being waged on Russia at the same time. Do you think that there were those kinds of incentives behind U.S. and NATO, maybe, as to what we're seeing?
From the start and since the downfall of the Soviet Union, openly, there are think tank publications in the U.S., and the nice things about our American friends is they're so open, so you can read it all. They wanted to bring Russia down same way as they did with the Soviet Union. If you look at the career of President Zelensky, he was sponsored by a Ukrainian oligarch with an Israeli passport who put him into his TV set, let him act in 23 series of a TV series and 23 sequels, and playing a little teacher who has become by chance president of the Ukraine. And that guy is an actor. He is a real complete puppet. He's a make-up story by some deep state interests, and these interests go very clearly. This is why they arm the Ukraine, even if they have no chance of withstanding. They arm it. They want to rather destroy Ukraine than let the Russian army do their job there for the Russian security. In fact, we know the run-up of atrocities by the Ukrainian armed forces on the Donbas Republic, terrible 14,000 deaths in 8 years. And then there's this Alley of Angels, the street where all the children are buried, which who lost their lives due to Ukrainian stories. So bring Russia down is the main incentive.
Okay, thank you so much for your contribution, James Tweedy, journalist and writer. And Christopher Horstall, pleasure, writer, politician, and an analyst from Berlin. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, COVID infection levels are rising in Scotland, figures suggest, as it was confirmed that the UK's scientific advisers no longer expect to meet regularly to discuss COVID. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's science correspondents Nicola Davis and Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled Scotland's COVID Cases Rise, while England and Northern Ireland show falls. In Britain, COVID infection levels are rising in Scotland, figures suggest, as it was confirmed that the UK's scientific advisers no longer expect to meet regularly to discuss COVID. About 1 in 19 people in Scotland had COVID in the week ending 26th of February, according to figures from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs from randomly selected households. By contrast, infection levels have continued to fall in England and in Northern Ireland, with the trend unclear in Wales. About 1 in 30 people in England are estimated to have had COVID in the week ending 26th of February. With infection levels still high across the United Kingdom, it was confirmed that the government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, known as SAGE, is not expecting to meet on COVID regularly, though it will stand ready if required. Friday, 4th of March's Office for National Statistics data reveals that the BA2 Omicron variant, a close cousin of the original BA1 variant of Omicron, but described as stealth, as it is harder to track, is on the rise in all of United Kingdom countries except Northern Ireland. The BA1 variant of Omicron is in decline in all countries except Scotland. Infection levels in Scotland peaked mostly recently in early January, when about 1 in 18 people had COVID, with levels falling to 1 in 30 by the middle of the month. Since then, they have been rising steadily. The increase appears to be in those around the ages of 30 and 60. With the trend uncertain for children and younger adults. An increase has also been seen in data for confirmed COVID patients in hospital in Scotland. After reaching a peak of 1,571 on 19th of January, the figure fell, hitting 868 on 13th of February. Since then, it has risen to 1,272 COVID patients in hospital in Scotland on 3rd of March. The uptick has not been reflected in hospital admissions data. However, one expert suggested that may be linked to a data problem. Professor Christina Pagel, Director of University College London's Clinical Operational Research Unit and a member of the independent SAGE group, said it was unclear what was behind the trend in Scotland. Professor Christina Pagel said, "I think the situation in Scotland is quite concerning. They are clearly an outlier in UK with rising number of cases. By Office of National Statistics and their dashboard and rising people in hospital," she said, adding the decline in the number of people with COVID on their death certificate had also stalled. Professor Christina Pagel suggested there are a number of possible explanations for the trend, including that there may be more people in Scotland who have not previously been infected than in England, meaning the BA2 variant can spread more easily. Less likely, she said, was that a new subvariant of Omicron was starting to spread. Professor Pagel said another possibility is that a combination of factors such as the waning of protection from booster shots, an increase in mixing in wake of relaxed mitigations, and a rise in BA2 cases might be behind the trend. Professor Paul Hunter of University of East Anglia said there were also some early indications in case data for England that COVID could be on the rise, adding that that was more likely due to the increase in the more transmissible BA2 variant of Omicron. "That does not mean COVID measures should return," he said. "Ultimately, infections would then shoot up later in the year when vaccine effectiveness has fallen even more," he said. "But it is another reminder, if one were needed, that we are not out of the woods yet, and those people who are more vulnerable to severe disease do need to continue to do things like wearing face masks when indoors, in crowded environments, and of course, when going for a booster shot if and when called. The highly transmissible Omicron variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the most common form of which is known as BA1, now accounts for nearly all of the coronavirus infections globally. Though COVID cases have already peaked in some countries, scientists are now tracking a rise in cases caused by a close cousin of Omicron known as BA2, which is starting to outcompete BA1 in parts of Europe and Asia. The BA1 version of Omicron has been somewhat easier to track than prior variants. That is because BA1 is missing one of the three target genes used in a common PCR test. Cases showing this pattern were assumed by default to be caused by the BA1 version of Omicron. BA2 version of Omicron, sometimes known as a stealth subvariant, does not have the same missing target gene. Instead, scientists are monitoring it the same way they have monitored prior variants, including the Delta variant, by tracking the number of virus genomes submitted to public databases such as GISAID. As with other variants, an infection with BA2 can be detected by coronavirus home test kits, though they cannot indicate which variant is responsible, according to experts.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The political crisis in Libya took a turn for the worse recently, with the Tobruk-based House of Representatives in the country's east choosing former Interior Minister Fatih Beshagha as Prime Minister, while current Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah has vowed to continue in the post until an election is held.
I will accept no new transitional phase, and we will not step up from our role in the government that we promised the people until an election is held.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, today we are focusing on the unfolding political crisis in Libya, a country that now has two rival prime ministers. Now, this latest development counters UN efforts to reconcile the divided country. We are asking, will this North African state slide back into a civil war? In the second part of our program, we shall move to neighboring Sudan, where the military regime has continued its brutal crackdown on peaceful protesters calling for a return to civilian rule. Will the military give in to the demands by the masses? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Libya, one country, two prime ministers. On the 10th of February, the House of Representatives, based in eastern Libya, named former Interior Minister Fatih Beshaga to form a new government replacing incumbent Abdulhamid Dbeibeh. The parliament argues that the mandate of Dbeibeh's government had expired on the 24th of December when elections were scheduled to be held. Differences amongst Libyan political groups led to the indefinite postponement of the eagerly awaited polls. Dbeibeh insists that he will accept no new transitional phase or parallel authority and will hand over power only to an elected government.
The United Nations says it still recognizes Dbeibeh as Libya's interim prime minister. He's a spokesman for UN Secretary-General at a news conference.
Yesterday, Ms. Williams met with Prime Minister Abdulmahid Dbeibeh to discuss recent developments and the votes taken by the House of Representatives to adopt a constitutional amendment and designate a new prime minister. Ms. Williams reiterated the importance of all actors and institutions to work within the political framework and, above all, to preserve calm on the ground in the interest of Libya's unity and stability.
Now, to discuss the ongoing events in Libya, we contacted Mustafa Feturi, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thank you for having me.
Now, Mr. Feturi, Libya now has two prime ministers. Now, was there any legal basis that the Tobruk-based parliament relied on when it elected a new prime minister?
Well, of course, it's considered as a legal process because for several reasons. First of all, Mr. Dbeibeh's mandate was about to finish last December when the elections take place. That never happened. The elections did not take place. But many considered his continuation of being a prime minister, a caretaker prime minister, actually, because he lost the vote of confidence last September, as we mentioned earlier. Many considered that to be illegal. He should not be there, even though he is just a caretaker prime minister. That's one thing. The other thing, the parliament has the upper hand in this case, because without the confidence of the parliament, legally speaking, in a democratic process, however broken the process is, the parliament is supposed to be the authority in the country that decides who becomes the prime minister by voting and selection of names, you know, different names, and that's what happened. So it's in terms of being legal or not, I think it's quite legal. It also goes in accordance with the UN brokered agreement between the different Libyan factions that was signed in March last year in Geneva, and that brought in through what is known as the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum and meeting in Geneva, that selected Mr. Dbeibeh as a prime minister.
Different scenarios are emerging regarding the situation in Libya. One of the most likely scenarios is that the Dbeibeh government will continue to work, but Beshaga also establishes a parallel government as he promised upon his appointment by parliament.
I would like to thank the government of national unity headed by Abdulhamid Dbeibeh, who took on the responsibilities during a difficult phase. This is the democracy that ensures a peaceful transition of power, and I am confident that the government of national unity will be committed to these democratic principles.
Is there a risk of Libya sliding back to civil war if action is not taken to reconcile the warring factions?
The risk of going back to violence in the country at this time, because of this development, I think it's very minimal. Why? Two reasons. One is the fact that it is not something we have seen before, like the division between east of the country and west of the country. The strongest man in the east of the country who controls power on the ground, Mr. Khalifa Haftar, who leads the Libyan army over there, is supporting this election of Mr. Bashagha. The second reason, We have to remember that Mr. Bashar, as well as the current prime minister, acting prime minister, Mr. Dbeibah, are Misratins from the western Libyan city of Misrata, east of Tripoli. And that to see them fighting, actually, if any fight will happen, it will happen either in Tripoli, the capital, over the location of Bawr and the seat of Bawr, or in Misrata, their hometown. And Misratans, the social leadership as well as political figures, very unlikely to support this or let it happen.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah survived an apparent assassination attempt when bullets hit his car on the day a rival prime minister was elected. Now, the failed assassination came as armed groups mobilized more fighters and equipment in the capital over recent weeks amid concern that the political crisis could trigger fighting. Now, Mr. Fituri, do we have indications on who was actually involved in this assassination attempt?
Well, you know, the whole affair about this assassination attempt is very unclear, to say the least. I don't think there is any political motivation behind such an assassination attempt, and it's of course condemned, and it's total terrorism, if you like. But at the same time, having said this, I really doubt if something like this has happened, and if it did happen, I have to emphasize this. It has not been fully investigated, first of all. Second, it's very unlikely that any political party was behind this. And the third, we have to also indicate this fact that he's in Tripoli. And in Tripoli, there are dozens of armed militias. Not all of them are happy with him.
While the politicians tussle for power in Libya, for the common man in the street, the main concern remains the high cost of living. Libya topped the Maghreb countries in the consumer inflation rates during the past year, 2021.
People struggle to make ends meet. The cost of living is obscene. The state's budget is billions, while citizens have no hope whatsoever.
Libya plunged into chaos following the killing of the country's Muammar Gaddafi during a NATO operation. Since the fall of Gaddafi's authoritarian regime, Libya has been plagued by US-instigated violence, chaos, and terrorism. Now, as Europe's natural gas stability appears increasingly fragile due to the crisis in Ukraine, Libya is now seen as one of the supply alternatives. This has resulted in increased foreign meddling in this energy-rich North African country. Libya's political crisis has attracted imperialist and regional powers, specifically the United States, France, and the EU.
Other countries said to be part of the mix in Libya include Arab states of the Persian Gulf, Turkey, and neighboring Egypt, which support opposite ends of power. Now, a last question to you, Mr. Fituri. There have been reports of foreign involvement in Libya over the recent past. Now, are foreign powers involved in the current political stalemate in Libya?
Of course. The main problem in Libya since 2011, 11 years ago, has always been the foreign interference. You have conflicting interests for different countries, and the theater of conflict, if you like, the theater of conflict is Libya. So that has always been there. At the current political impasse, if you like, we have different countries that do not wish to see elections taking place, mainly because they believe whoever is coming might not serve their interests, might not help them help their vision or strategy in the long run in Libya. And there are those who try to spoil the whole thing, so Libya becomes more chaotic and easy to control. The foreign interference, unfortunately, has always been the problem in Libya since 2011.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fituri. As always, it's always great having you in our show. Now, let's take a short break. Our next subject will be on the continued crackdown of peaceful demonstrators in Sudan by the country's military. Stay with us.
Sudan's brutal crackdown.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Sudanese armed forces have continued their brutal crackdown on peaceful demonstrators across the country, demanding an end to the military rule. Protesters also want to see the release of political prisoners and justice for dozens of protesters killed since last year's coup.
These regular mass protests have been held in Sudan since October the 25th coup, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, which derailed the country's rocky transition to civilian rule following a 2019 removal of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir.
A demonstrator speaks here on the demands by the masses in the country.
We here and Sudanese everywhere have come out for the same reason today. We want freedom, peace and justice. We want a complete civilian government without the military. The military should stay in their barracks and focus on the country's security at the borders and not get in governance. No military will rule this country. This country is the country of the people. The government is for the people and the military should be in the barracks.
Now for more on the fragile situation in Sudan, we contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Now, at least 80 protesters have been killed by Sudanese security forces since the coup occurred in 2021. It appears the military junta is clinging to power with an iron fist. Mr. Mbaluto, what's your take on this?
We've seen military making different approaches to appease the protest. Of course, we saw their latest move when they tried to free the former prime minister. And then in a minute, they tried to contain him because they signed an agreement with him to carry on with their leadership, but also including him. But he didn't have much say about it, making him ending up in resigning. And of course, since that time, all we have seen in Sudan is just continuous protest. Because, I think Sudanese have come to realize that the military is not serious in terms of changing. They just want to carry on as normal. They want to rule. They kicked off the civilian part of leadership in the coalition, and now it's just the military, basically. So they seem to be very desperate to frustrate all these people until they just accept that rulership.
Relentless protests have rocked Sudan since the military coup last October. Fresh crackdowns on protesters will likely complicate UN efforts to find a way out of the country's crisis. The UN spokesman elaborates here on the ongoing efforts to reconcile warring parties in Sudan.
Turning to Sudan, the first stage of the UN's facilitated consultations for political process on the way forward has concluded. The first stage began on January 8th and brought together a range of groups, including civil society, women's rights groups, political parties, academics, journalists, and others. The Secretary General's Special Representatives in Sudan, Volker Perthes, said he heard a range of perspectives and proposals from the Sudanese people to overcome the current political crisis. He expressed his gratitude for the commitment and enthusiasm of representatives of groups from across Sudan who came to meet with the UN, engage constructively and share their concrete ideas.
Despite the brutal crackdown in Sudan, the masses have continued with their protests, demanding a return to civilian rule. What are the driving forces behind the consistency in these protests?
And these are determined activists who do not let go. And they're also instrumental to the protests globally against, you know, hanging on to power of former President Omar Bashir. But you see, they are still the same, you know, they've gone back to Sudan because they realized Omar Bashir is gone, but now the greatest enemy in terms of dictatorship hanging on to power undemocratically has been the military. They are already on the ground organizing and facilitating and overseeing the protest. And these are the people right now whom the military is focusing on in terms of abduction, in terms of detaining them without even any formal trial.
Sudan's military ruler, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, confirmed meetings between Sudanese and Israeli regime officials, claiming they were for security cooperation, not politics. Sudanese masses and political parties have already rejected the military regime's decision to normalize relations with the Israeli regime.
When we talk about the normalization deal with Israel, I think it was a big mistake that will stoke division in Sudan. Many parties in the transitional government have rejected this deal. It will be rejected by the Sudanese people as well. It was a personal decision by members of the government like Burhan and Hamdok. This deal will be resisted by other parties and by the Sudanese people themselves.
Is the Sudanese military leadership increasing its brutal crackdown on civilians due to support by some Western powers and the Israeli regime?
When it comes to global engagement, we have seen a lot of countries, US, Britain, UK as well, talking about, we want return to civilian leadership in Sudan. And therefore, this is not the time some countries to begin to, you know, take these guys very lightly and friendly. No, it's time to say no civilian government, no engagement. And therefore, that's where things go wrong. When it comes to some countries are pro the military junta, others are not. It won't work for the Sudanese people. And I say most of the time when you imagine yourself living in a country since independence, there's never been democratic rule. It's all coups and stuff. No, it's not the way to go. The way to go is let the Sudanese people, civilian leadership, have the prominence, focus, be the thing that everybody wants.
Sudan's strategic location and its resources, especially oil and vast agricultural land, have made it attractive to imperialist powers meddling in the region, especially the United States and the Israeli regime. Now, these imperialist powers have long-term interests in weakening the Republic of Sudan, and this was actually the reason they encouraged South Sudan to break away in 2011. Now, foreign powers have for a long time been interfering in Sudan, and this has exacerbated the crisis in this country. Now, in your opinion, what's the reason for this meddling?
Sudan is an amazing country, you know, technically, because of civil war, it broke into the Sudan and, of course, South Sudan. And the international community, different countries have employed different measures to be the ones who benefit. I'll give you an example. During when United Nations gave arms embargo, which means no country was supposed to sell arms to the Sudanese government in Khartoum, China was still against the UN embargo, selling arms to the government in Khartoum. yet again the same country chain was also brokering deals of oil production within South Sudan. So in South Sudan, they are brokering deals of oil production. In the north, they are selling arms. And when you challenge them, they say it's just business. Business, arms are for sale. Okay, oil, yeah, it's business. It's, we have agreements, we have contracts. You have all these international players. Most of the time, it happens to be focus on resources rather than stability of that country and the sovereignty of that country. So it's still the same ploy when you look into any other different international community in different countries. Most of these countries are for themselves rather than for the individual Sudanese people.
While announcing his resignation early January, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok said the country was at a dangerous turning point threatening its survival. For several years, massive anti-government demonstrations have been taking place in Sudan, mostly over economy. The protesters, youth for a large part, demanded the resignation of then-President Omar al-Bashir. A demonstrator who took part in those protests says they will not relent until their demands are met.
I took part in the 2013, 2016 and 2018 protests against Bashir. And here I am now and will continue to protest until our demands are met. I will keep protesting until there is a civilian government and there is peace, freedom and justice.
Now that clearly shows the firm resolve and determination of the Sudanese people in attaining their rights. Mr. Mbaluto, do you think the Sudanese military will eventually give in to the demands of the masses?
With the sustained protests going on, with the lack of relenting within the protesters' fraternity and leadership, it's not giving up, I think, and also lack of a lot of endorsement by this military junta over there in Sudan, it's like a setup whereby you'll never go forever. Not quite. Because at some point, you just realize, oh, you can't continue. You cannot keep this going. I believe AU as well, Africa Union, will be very, keen to see that civilian leadership comes back to Sudan. So when you look into the future, I don't see the military having a greater future there. But the challenge is to send military to facilitate change in Sudan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baluto, for your time. It's been great having you. Now, and as our guest said, the main challenge in Sudan remains the unwillingness of the military to facilitate transition to civilian rule. Now, we shall keep our eyes on Sudan and give you up-to-date analysis. Now that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
headlines. Iran